From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're hearing from Scott Simon, a longtime practitioner of the Chicago School of Journalism, whose guiding philosophy is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. Since 1985, Simon has been most recognizable as the voice of NPR's Weekend Edition, in addition to his work as an essayist and author of both fiction and nonfiction books. He's distinguished himself as a war correspondent and an unflagging fan of sports, specifically the Chicago Cubs and Bulls, as well as an empathetic and insightful essayist. Last month, Simon spoke to a capacity crowd at WHQR's annual luncheon, and in just a moment, we'll hear his opening remarks as he takes stock of where journalism is today. And later in the show, we'll share our own interview with Simon, where we pushed a little deeper into the conversation about the state of news, and to use a metaphor I think Simon would appreciate, talked a little inside baseball. But first, here's Simon from our event last month.
I'm very moved to be here on your 40th anniversary, and I want to thank WHQR and all of you who are here for making what we do at NPR possible each and every day. And it's especially important, I think, in these times that roil with wrenching issues, that we provide light more than heat and facts, not just myths. That's more important than ever. And I want to thank you very personally for the rich life that I've just been able to enjoy, and I do mean enjoy, doing stories around the world. I've had a few close calls, but many more imperishable memories and friendships around the world, and a meaning in life, in addition to being a husband, a father, and a Michael Jordan fan. You know, one of the differences between covering the news in blogs and tweets and doing it for a living, which is what we do at NPR and WHQR, is professionalism. And that's to say, we all have personal beliefs, though it's been my experience over the years that there's nothing like journalism to shake up the personal beliefs that you thought you had. But we certainly believe we can do our jobs and report fairly. I am, by tradition and temperament and imagination, and even design, a Chicago journalist. You know, any self-image I have in the job is steeped in that old Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur play, The Front Page. I suspect this was a play that many of us have loved, made into a fine movie with Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell. You have to be selective in your affection for certain parts of it today, let me just put it that way. And absolutely, the job then was not inclusive. It was often casually bigoted and despicably sensationalist and routinely boorish. But those undereducated, maladjusted, overbearing, and often debauched news people, I say that with some pride, also helped create a vital and competitive popular news industry. And that was something that was new and distinct to America. Journalists weren't just the voice of and didn't work for a political party or a movement. They were the news. They reported for a living. You know, the great daily news columnist of that era was Finley Peter Dunne, and he coined what became known as a motto for American journalism, Chicago journalism, but it became a motto for American journalism. Our job is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And look, I don't mind saying we do say job. Those of us who are blessed enough to do this for our life's work also know we have to make that work. We have to make it pay enough to keep going. You know, I've always felt a little awkward at award ceremonies over the years when journalists salute each other for courageous reporting. Russian journalists, they're courageous. Mexican journalists, killed by drug cartels, they're courageous. There are other journalists around the world who've died in Myanmar, the Philippines, been jailed in China, Cuba, and Iran. I've covered conflicts overseas in Central America, Bosnia, the Middle East, and I've certainly felt in danger a few times, usually by my own miscalculation. I was on the enemies list in El Salvador, and really I would have been embarrassed not to be. But I knew I'd be safe if I got home. A lot of our colleagues in other societies around the world are not safe, especially in their homes. That's where they've been pushed from windows, as in Russia, and slaughtered in hallways. And we should hold them in our thoughts and hearts every day, because they don't just receive an angry tweet now and then. It's their life and death. You know, I think a lot of us make journalism a living because it's gratifying and fun, I hate to say it, to try and find and tell stories and look at history in the face and ask sharp critical questions of people in power and tell stories of people who think that they've been overlooked. A free press, as we heard, I think in so many words in that beautiful statement that you read, Kevin, is the fresh air you need to keep a democracy breathing. But I want to use this occasion of your 40th anniversary to bring up to you a concern I have in recent years that I think our biggest danger may not be in this country what we think it is, but the echo chambers that we have engineered for ourselves in a free society. The fact is, people can now choose any news they want. They don't have to disturb themselves with a story or facts or opinions that might chance to upset their view of the world. You know, I hear from people every week who believe the moon landing was a hoax. They send me videos to support that view. People who believe September 11th was a fraud perpetrated by the CIA, Mossad, the International Jewish Conspiracy, take your pick, find support for this slander and begin to think of themselves as a community, not lunatics. People who chant blood and soil, an old Nazi slogan on the soil of the United States, which has been nourished by the blood and the lives of people from all over the world, can now form their old kind of e-world, sealed off from real humanity. Millions of good and conscientious Americans now fill themselves with the news they choose that nourishes only the views they already hold. And I'm afraid, in a way, it's a return to those times when political movements and parties sponsored newspapers. You know, people sometimes congratulate public figures or commentators or comedians. My father, as many of you may know, was a comedian. People meaning to compliment me will say, I'm sure he spoke truth to power. My father told mother-in-law jokes, which I guess in a way is speaking truth to power, but the fact is, more and more Americans from all political corners are happy just to talk to themselves. Over and over, tweet after tweet, post after post. And I'm afraid that people who talk to themselves, whether it's mumbling to yourself on the subway or echoing only the people who agree with you, need help. We've used this vast and dazzling power of the internet to connect us to the world, then closed ourselves off from different points of view. We've too often used this astounding information technology to not inform ourselves, but just confirm whatever we'd like to believe. I think our friends at WHQR might have the same experience. Every day I get emails saying, I don't listen to NPR to hear, dot, dot, dot. And they finish the sentence with a point of view, a person, a group of people, or an area of interest they seem convinced will impart a fatal rash if they so much as hear the words. And it depresses me that after so many decades where good journalists have strived to bring a variety of opinions and experiences to people, so many Americans now choose to close their ears and their hearts and minds. In these times, I think that command that we can take from our founding days in American journalism to afflict the comfortable also means challenging the comfortable nostrums and notions that our audiences may have about the world, left, right, and center. You know, at NPR, we just don't pat the audience on the head and say, you know, you're right. You're smarter than everyone else. Everything you think is right, and we're going to help you keep thinking that way. It's having the nerve and the respect and the professionalism to tell an audience the story may shake your views. And that's what we're here to do. I think now and then we have to remind our audiences there is no safe space in journalism. We should advise our listeners, in this space you will encounter words that rile and even offend you. Views that appall and depress you, facts that defy your own views, reporting that upsets and distresses you. And that's why we're here. That's why we think journalism is worth doing. And when we hear the cliches of our times, normalize, marginalize, the so-and-so community empower, synergize, we should strike them out and speak with clarity. By the way, I have to tell you, being introduced with iconic, I think our staff will tell you I go nuts when I see the word iconic. And I said to our staff a little while ago, generally speaking, icons are dead. And somebody pointed that that's out in my official biography and said, yeah. When the powerful in a society bully and slur, we should strike back with civility. And when they lie, we have to correct them. This is a tough business. It should be. The stakes are real. In journalism, we put a hand on events that can affect elections and reputations and life and death sentences, and events large, small, and enduring. But we should make a pledge to remind the public we are in journalism, not the academy or a yoga workshop or a Zen monastery. Journalism is the profession of the front page, not Mary Poppins. It should and can be accomplished with civility and decency. But journalism is also rough and tumble. It's a contact sport, not a Montessori kindergarten. I am proud to work for a news organization that knows and honors this, and I thank you for making it possible all these years. In an America that's so deeply divided and vulnerable to misinformation, the work that we do, the work that our colleagues at WHQR, has never been more important or vital. One of my favorite stories, not my favorite story, our past couple of years, we did a story about a 10-way kidney transplant at Houston Methodist Hospital. 22 people were involved and their families. They were more or less all from Texas. And I know from talking to the families, some of them had voted one way in 2016 and 2020. Some of them had voted the other way. But when somebody came to them and said, you can save somebody's life, they didn't ask how'd they vote. One of the most moving things I've ever seen. Our rumpled forebears in this business were among the deplorables of their times, obnoxious, sweaty, and rowdy, but they created modern reporting that opened news to the public, independent of party, lobby, or faction. They told stories about murders, riots, wars, crimes, bribes. Don't act like you haven't heard that here in North Carolina. Revolutions, nonsense, and inanities, because it's all part of our human story. And citizens of a democracy have the right to know, and we can be better citizens when they do. Journalists are not descended from timorous tribes of people who cringe at criticism or shudder at second guessing. From a president, from politicians, or even our own public. When there is carping on social media platforms and kvetching and verbal assault from high places and self-important platforms, I think we should keep in mind the example of Wilmington's own Michael Jordan. Just take the hits and keep on going. Thank you.
That was NPR's Scott Simon speaking at WHQR's annual luncheon that we held last month. If you want to hear more, including a Q&A with the audience, you can find that on our show page at whqr.org. Coming up after a quick break, we'll hear more from Simon as he sat down with us for a one-on-one interview. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. Up now, we're sitting down with NPR's Weekend Edition host, Scott Simon. Well, Scott Simon, it is a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks. It's very good to be here.
So I want to start by asking about the thing that we are both involved in at our own various scales, and that is public radio.
Yeah.
It is not the highest tech thing. It's not the newest thing. It is not the shiniest Cybertruck on the block, but
yeah,
it does seem to have some staying power.
Yes.
And I'm curious what you ascribe that to.
You know, this is going to sound very low level, but it's good company. I think it becomes part of everyone's life. People who turn it on in the morning, people who get up to hear our show on Saturday. I've heard from them for years now. I think it's good company. Do they want to know what's going on in the world? Yes, absolutely. And do they find out? Yes, absolutely. But I think it's good. It's companionship. It's something that is good to have in your life. And as with all great friendships, it contains many vicissitudes and many different shades and stories that are unpleasant, but things that you need to hear. Stories that are just fun and help pick you up. And stories from all around the world. It doesn't put us into a small niche.
It is good company. You use the word vicissitudes, mm-hmm. which reminds me of how it's different than TV news.
That I said vicissitudes?
Yes,
yeah,
that you would go that deep into a vocabulary bench.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sometimes sorry about that because I really, as our staff will tell you, I hate these kind of bromidic New Age cliches, putting community on the end of everything, referring to any kind of change as an inflection point.
It's insufferable.
Yes, right. Thanks very much. It is. And it, more to the point, sort of has a kind of academic insularity about it that I think, you know, it shuts off for many people. I have no problem, however, using a word like vicissitudes. I think people either know it or they kind of know it from the context. And it's not nomenclature. It's not techno-speak.
No,
and that's what I think is bad.
I think what is good about the style of public radio is that it's easy to parody, but hard to disagree with, that it's important to tell mm-hmm. people what is really happening in the full complexity of the way it exists in the world.
Yeah. No, and by the way, I mean, I could be, I don't want to go too far with this, but I think the fact that it's easy to parody is actually positive. It means that we have an identifiable kind of personality that communicates across various people. And look, you know, branders would die for that, wouldn't they? And we have that. And I think, look, and nobody, it's been my experience, I imagine it might be the same around here, nobody makes more savage fun and parodies what we sound like more than we, those of us who are responsible for it. I've certainly can take off at a moment's notice into saying, oh, that is so NPR and that sort of thing.
I will sometimes be in the car with my wife and a promo for a show will come on with my voice and she will just look at me and go.
Yes, I've had the same experience, yes.
So another thing about NPR that we pride ourselves on at whatever scale you work at, whether you're at the mothership or here, is that we try really damn hard to be objective.
Yes.
And as you said, multi-sided, not just both sides, because there are usually many sides to a story. And yet we cannot stop getting pilloried for being somehow liberal. And maybe it's our vocabulary choice and maybe it's the breathy delivery.
I should explain. On social media, I also get pilloried for being conservative or what people think are conservative.
That's probably a good sign.
If
you get it both ways.
Yes. No, I would say that, except shouldn't be the one to say that. But yes, no, I think there are people who obviously I think we get and have been for years portrayed as being liberal. And, you know, that's just part of the cost of doing business, I think. But increasingly, at least on social media platforms, at least the tweets that I read, we're also pilloried for being conservative.
It's certainly pilloried for being...
Or what they consider to be conservative, yeah.
I have my younger colleagues and acquaintances will often pillory ourselves for being perhaps too credulous of the United States government, for example. And certainly my conservative friends often make us sound like we have just dropped acid at NYU during the height of the post-structuralist revolution. And I don't think either are true, but at the current moment, I feel like we are, in public media, are getting a lot of criticism for being too liberal. And I don't know, in your experience, if this comes in waves, will this ever end? Is this cyclical?
Well, I don't know. Is it'll ever end? I think a lot of people put a name and a label on something because it helps them talk about it and identify it. You know, just as, by the way, when I hear jargon I don't like, I, you know, will refer to it as insular academic activist hyphenated jargon. That's how I finish the sentence that way. So people tend to do that. I don't know if it'll end, but I think criticism and learning how to both reply when it's appropriate and just kind of shake it off when it's just the cost of doing business is part of what we have to put up with. And look, I'm actually glad for that. We live in a free society. People can express themselves. And it's interesting that you should talk about young people and the staff who think that sometimes NPR can be more credulous of, you know, the U.S. government. It has been my experience, and certainly I think we've seen it in recent years, people who call themselves conservative are absolutely not trusting in the U.S. government or what they consider to be the word of the U.S. government. And
I want to put a pin in that. And then hang streamers on it, because I think that's a very, very valid point. And I think the anti-government flavor of the Tea Party, now ratcheted up on crack and steroids, that we see makes it a little more difficult to identify what the traditional conservative position and what the traditional liberal opinion might be.
The first few times I heard the phrase deep state, it was used by people on the left to describe what they felt as the military security establishment, the deep state, that no matter how the election went, the deep state would keep control. Now, obviously, you hear it used by people who would say that they're on the right.
A related question to the idea of political bias is just, I think, an evolving sense of how much informed opinion can be part of the news. You are famous for your essays, which sometimes have opinions.
They do, but I leave room for other kinds of opinions. I very carefully crouch my language. I think I went over the line, and I don't mind it, when it came to Bosnia.
That's an extraordinary set of circumstances, I think.
Yes, and when it comes to the Chicago Cubs.
Yes, and you weren't a huge fan of Eminem.
No, yeah.
But I mean, I wouldn't call you, you know, anywhere near the same category of a talking head or an opinion radio shock.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. No.
I don't think I could make that stick. But there needs to be, when I talk to younger journalists, they feel like they have a burning need, and they feel like the world needs journalists who don't just report the facts, who report the facts and add context and backstory. And obviously you don't start 15 billion years ago and go to now. So you're picking what history and what backstory and what context you're giving. And so not everyone likes that. They call it opinion, but it is really facts and context.
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone knows how we're exactly supposed to manage that responsibility.
Well, I don't either. And when you talk about content and backstory, as you point out, I mean, where do you begin? I don't know the answer to that, except I think it's probably not arbitrary. And context and backstory are obviously important. I also think it depends on where you stand in a breaking news situation. If a plane crashes, the first thing you say is that it fell out of the air. I don't think you're in a position at that moment to say, because of mistakes in the production line that have been, or else you'll make a mistake that, you know, could be, you might have to retract. Unfortunately, it has already had a real effect in the lives of many.
I mean, I think of something like the other factor here is I think of things like global warming, where many major news outlets have decided we are no longer going to debate the 0.1% of scientists who don't agree with this. And some moral issues, to your point, a saying I heard when I was young is, we do not give 6 minutes to the Jews and 6 minutes to the Nazis. Mm-hmm. So there are some bright line issues where I see young journalists struggle, where I struggle, to be honest, is which are the newest bright line issues. Does that make sense?
I have actually covered Nazis. The American Nazi Party wanted to march through Skokie, Illinois, famous case. One of the first protracted pieces of reporting that I did for NPR. Those guys are actual Nazis. They weren't just hateful figures that you would call Nazis. They were swastikas and Sieg Heil and that sort of thing. And we would occasionally put what they said on the air about Jews. And I would tell you that that was necessary for people to actually hear it being uttered. I mean, I will never forget being at a march that they ultimately had on the southwest side of Chicago in a park, public park called Marquette Park. And you had people in the crowd, and not just one or two, scores of people shouting, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. And I would tell you it was important to have that on the air for people to hear it. Nowadays, you might hear people say, well, why give them airtime? And I don't have a facile answer for that except to say I think we made the best decision that we did at that particular time. And I think when it is really expressive of something that's happening in a news story, you need to do it. And I'm uncomfortable with the argument that why should we give these so-and-sos airtime? Because I think it's necessary for people to hear every aspect of a story. And not because they're equal, but because it's necessary for them to know about it. I mean, and it's interesting because, of course, that was a very important story to the country at that particular time. And as the American Civil Liberties Union, who was defending the rights of the American Nazi Party to march through the predominantly Jewish suburb of Skokie, Illinois, see other phrases are coming back to me, used to say, our defendant is not the American Nazi Party, it's the First Amendment. And I think that that is something that's important to remember. You know, our operating principle is the First Amendment.
I think that is the kind of Enlightenment value that I grew up with.
It's under question now. Absolutely.
I share your concern that if you do that story now, you would be accused of platforming or whatever the term du jour is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you a different kind of question about your reporting, if I can. And that is, and we've talked about this in the newsroom, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but you are one of the few voices we hear on the radio that occasionally departs from that measured, even, friendly, intelligent, but warm kind of tone that NPR shoots for in two different, very different directions. One is extreme exuberance over on the topic of sports.
Yes, I know.
But the other is you have moments of real emotional vulnerability on there.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Which is not something even NPR listeners are used to hearing all the time.
Yeah, I know.
And it can be jarring and touching and the question I've heard.
And there are people who say, put a cork in it. Yeah.
That's enough. Right. Yeah. Man up. But at the same time, my younger colleagues have asked, because they are looking down the road at 40, 50 years of journalism, how do you stay emotionally open without that just scarring over?
I guess I'm not sure that I do all the time. I don't know. And I can't control it. I mean, I've tried to put a cork in it, tamp it down. That sometimes just makes it worse. It's interesting. When, for example, I have interviewed people in Sarajevo during the siege about terrible losses, I think I would not cry as they talked. I might occasionally give vent to some moisture in the eyes. But I think on mic, because I wanted to get them to talk. However, when I talk about what they face today, I often, and you've seen it, I think, you know, melt into tears. My children are an entirely different category. I can't go on talking, you know, without, oh, my word. So I won't test myself with that now. And I can't quite explain it. I mean, a number of years ago, I was answering questions at some public forum. I mean, it must have been in Chicago because my mother was in the audience. And I was talking about our daughters who were younger then, and I began to tear. And my mother turned to my wife and said, "Darling, is Scotty sick? Does he have some kind of terrible disease? Why is he so..." "He's just talking about your daughter's playing. What, you know?" And my wife said, "Oh, Pat, he is always like that." My wife is French. I can't begin to explain it, except to say when I'm doing a job, I try and look. I mean, I remember anchoring our coverage when the space shuttle Columbia crashed, and I was a terrible event. I didn't, you know, I anchored a lot of our 9/11 coverage. And I think my voice got caught up a couple of times. I remember being at Ground Zero. Oh, I was answering somebody's question. I forget. But I mean, this was 3 or 4 days into it. And yeah, I became just overcome answering the question and seeing all those remains among the cinders. I did, absolutely. But I did answer the question.
The other question, I have this question too. I think all of our staff would like to ask, is about the voice of NPR. And a very jarring experience for me when I first came to public media. I had been in the digital world where, mm-hmm. you know, we wrote to be read and not to be listened to. So it didn't matter what we sounded like.
Yeah.
And so we didn't get feedback. We got feedback about our attitude, mm-hmm. our tone, maybe, but not our voices. It wasn't a thing I ever thought about. And when I started here at HQR, we got an email from an older woman who was really unhappy with the way Aisha Roscoe sounded on the air.
Oh, my God.
But this woman thought that this was not the sound of America. This was not the sound that she wanted coming out of her radio. And you must get that from time to time. And what do you think about the person who feels that way?
Well, first, I think they're wrong. And if she... You know, if she doesn't like Aisha's voice, I think I would suggest she listen to her and change her opinion. I think listening to her and hearing Aisha's warmth and humor and the way she engages with people, I think she'll be converted. You know, and if not, okay, keep your tote bag and thanks for listening. There are people who can't stand my voice, and I'm not in a position to say they're wrong. I mean, Bob Edwards had a great voice, late Bob Edwards, God rest his soul. My friend Robert Siegel, a great voice. Lynn Neary, who was on NPR for years, absolutely a great voice. Susan Stamberg still has a great voice that expresses such character and mirth for I think that is the word I want, come to think of it. So many great voices. I don't have one of those. People trying to be nice to me will say, "Oh, you have such a nice voice." I don't. I mean, there are many people just at NPR who have much better voices than I do. I got to live with it at this point.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll have more from our interview with Scott Simon in just a minute. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We're returning now to our interview with NPR's Scott Simon. What are ways of looking at the future of NPR? We have seen NPR try to explore the world of podcasts. We've seen NPR add things on with, I don't think, taking much away from its core mm-hmm. product. Is that, we get these doom and gloom emails all the time about how, you know, the last generation of real radio listeners is shuffling off this mortal coil as we speak.
Huh?
Surely you have heard similar rumors.
Sure, yeah.
And that there needs to be some kind of paradigm shift at NPR. And then we hear from people who are not so sure. We feel like there's an entire generation who is just now realizing it's nice to have that voice with you on the car ride.
I go with the second. It seems to me every time we try and make one of those paradigm shifts, we wind up thinking, oh, what the hell were we thinking about? You know, look, and I have no problem saying this. News skews old. I think there will always be an important part of the younger demographic that is interested in news. But I think you have to grow up in the world and contend with it a little bit. And some of it is, you know, is based on events. I think, for example, my generation was drawn into the news because the war was going on in Vietnam. And we might be, absolutely caught up in it. For that matter, the Civil Rights Revolution. I think there are similar issues today, but obviously there are different ways of people finding out about the world, and there are also different ways of people who don't necessarily want to explore what the news is deeply. And I say this with respect and love for our own daughters who feel very deeply about three or four issues that concern them. As citizens and people who they are. But do they follow the news? Not that much. Not the same way that my wife and I do. They hear about stuff. And I just think that's a generational difference. As they hold jobs and get out into the world and have families, I think more of that will engage them. And look, we are friends to this day with a wonderful photographer named Tabitha Soren. And Tabitha was the host of MTV News.
She was the host at a very formative time in my life.
All right. Okay.
So I know exactly who you're talking about.
Okay. And you know how successful MTV News was then, right?
That is how I got all my news.
And people thought, well, if you just put rock music to news and just, you know, and that'll bring people along. And of course that, because it was still the news, it wasn't necessarily, it didn't interest that demographic that they were going for. And I think we shouldn't demean the news and for that matter, people who come into our audience by thinking all we have to do is twist with this or that. And look, I think we should be popular. That is very important to me. I don't want a niche audience. I think we should be, you know, popular across the board, and we do have young listeners. But will the people listening to NPR news programs be the same demographic that listens to Tiny Desk concerts? Perhaps not. But that's why we're a network. We can do many different things at a time. And I think it's important to do that. And that, you know, and NPR has had some very successful podcasts and obviously some podcasts that have had to be closed up. And I think that's the podcast world. I think as we've known that. Our friend Eric Newsom, who wrote a very good book on podcasts, and Eric used to be at NPR. I'm going to be paraphrasing him, but he said something like, you know, there are 10 million podcasts in the world today, and 2 years from now they won't be there.
And for quite some period of time, there was a very large listening audience that had quite a bit of time on their hands.
Yes, and that's
to listen to podcasts.
Yeah. And so I think that'll change in ebb and flow. I think what we can offer on our news programs that podcasts quite can't is live. Is when something important happens in the news, we are there. And I think it's very important to have something that does that, that's responsible and reliable and will be with people, even and especially when there's breaking and unfolding news. We have to repeat ourselves, you know, if you just joined us, to those of us who are listening, you know, and I happen to like breaking news and God forbid, even though we sometimes have to throw some wonderful pieces overboard when something terrible happens in the world. And we host breaking news, I feel energized and uplifted because I think it's one of the most important things that we can do for people. And that's something we don't have in podcasts right now, the sensation of a situation involving itself in real time and we can bring people along in that. And I think there is always going to be a future in that.
You were talking at the luncheon about the hard scrabble roots of Chicago journalism and journalism in general. I'm a local journalist, so we still have some of that, warts and all, I would say.
Yeah.
And we always hope that you don't have to sneak it inside a platinum package or gamify it, or that just good damn reporting will get through to somebody.
Yeah, I think that's true. Somebody just, you know, speaking about what's happened and telling us the story insofar as we can discern it, I think that has, forgive me, enormous dramatic value. And I think that's one of the important things we can do.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I hope so too.
Wait. Time will tell.
You know what? It's not that, as cliches go, it's a good one, though.
Yeah, it's fine.
It's good. All right, so my last question for you is, during the election, someone asked you how your optimism was doing.
Yes.
If I can impose upon you to take a second crack at that.
All right, yeah, because I kind of dismissed it by talking about the Cubs, and I'm actually very optimistic.
You've reported on politicians for too long. You've learned a few tricks.
Yes, absolutely. that's a good one. I wish I could give a really hopeful answer about where our politics seem to be at this point and where national life seems to be. And as I think I did say at the luncheon, because, of course, my wife is French, and so we have a kind of foot in French events too. It's not just the United States. It's Western. It's all over the world.
You have a far-right party taking a huge chunk of the government and Germany,
yes,
for the first time since the last time.
You know, it happened in Italy. They are scoring big numbers in France at this particular point. So it's happening all over. I am optimistic about individuals that I encounter all over the world who are doing something important and not, in a funny way, letting that get in the way. I also talked at the luncheon about a story we did at Houston Methodist Hospital. Been, I guess, about a year and a half. 10-way kidney transplant. And this is a chain transplant, one to the other, to the other, to the other. And these were all people from the vicinity in Texas. And we interviewed most of them. It was simultaneous operations, so we spent some time with them the night before. I'll add parenthetically, so I went into this young couple. She was donating part of a kidney to someone who she wouldn't meet for a few days later who could use it. And, you know, and nervous, what's going to happen? And they'd been through a lot. And her husband was wearing a Houston Astros cap. Maybe I don't need to explain the Astros got caught up in a World Series cheating scandal where they beat on garbage drums to send signals of what pitch was coming. So I said, look, I know this is an important and emotional night, but can we ask you some questions? And he said, well, yeah, you can ask. I don't know if I have any answers. And I said, because he had the Astros cap on, I said, well, I tell you what, I'll ask you the question, then I'll bang on this garbage can to tell you the answer. And he just laughed and laughed and laughed, and we became good friends after that. All of which is a way of saying getting to know the families. I know that some of them voted one way in 2016 and 2020. Some of them voted the other. But when doctors came to them and said you could save somebody's life by donating a kidney, they didn't ask that question. I said, sure. Yeah. What do we do? And that kind of thing keeps me going. I think there's still a lot of generosity and a sense of purpose out there. And I like to think that at some point our political system and our politics and our public profile are going to rise to meet it. I certainly hope so.
I had a journalism professor 25-odd years ago who said that journalism had made him love people and deeply hate humanity. And I don't think you're that cynical. I don't think you're that cynical.
No, I'm not that. I'm not that cynical, but I guess I'm on a knife's edge that way. I've been blessed to meet people all over the world doing extraordinary things.
And I do want to close with that sentiment that you shared today, that a greater risk maybe than, you know, some kind of resurgent World War II style fascism would be that we all just die alone in our silos.
Yeah.
And the fear of platforming, the fear of talking to someone you shouldn't talk to, the fear of engaging with an idea that might be too far left or right in the Overton window. I know there are young journalists who feel they're up against that, and they don't want to take a wrong step. They feel like it's that scene in Indiana Jones where you have to go very carefully.
Look, I I'm at a different point in my career. I can maybe take some chances that I think young journalists think they can't. And I don't even know that. You know, I hear from people on social media platforms, you know, I've had it with you, Scott Simon, because you interviewed J.D. Vance.
You've been canceled. I've seen it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what to say. Look, I next to the luncheon that we had for your 40th anniversary, I sat next to a woman we know who is with an adoption group. Both of our daughters happen to be adopted. And every week I hear from people who, every week, every few days, I hear from people who are opposed to international and interracial adoption, not who you might think they are. These are people who think that we have stolen babies from their native culture. And what especially distresses me about this, of course, is thanks to social media algorithms, this is stuff that our daughters can see, although it's hardly a new, you know, they have friends who raise that with them. And the people who write those things on social media platforms, you know, they consider themselves the most progressive people on earth. And, you know, I don't know what to say. I mean, I'm not going to give the kind of answers that I occasionally do. We adopted them from orphanages. They would have not had a life ratifying their native culture. They would have been at work in a factory when they were 11. But I also feel a little more confident now as parents. Have they had substantially different lives because we adopted them than they would have if they had stayed in China? Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And that's life. And, you know, my mother left Belfast for America. Did she have a different life in Chicago than she would have had in Belfast? Yeah. I don't know as her parents needed to apologize for it. Did she take away from the Irish state at that point? Maybe. I can't finish all of that. But all of which is a way of saying I think at some point we can't be second-guessed. We have to form our own moral center and proceed with what we think is best. And as I think I said at the luncheon, like Michael Jordan, just take the hits and keep on going for the basket.
Well, Scott Simon, I had heard rumors that you were a mensch, and you have failed to disprove those allegations.
That so I was nice?
That you were nice.
Oh, Jesus, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know where that's... See what I mean? See the kind of nonsense that can be on social media platforms?
Scott Simon, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. My thanks to our guest today, Scott Simon, for his time during our luncheon, our sit-down interview, and for a lovely evening he spent with the WHQR news team at dinner. We got him to try fried green tomatoes, and he told us a few stories from the rough and ready days of Chicago journalism. Stories that, I am delighted to tell you, would be completely inappropriate for radio. And while I can't share those stories, if you want to hear the full talk that he gave at our luncheon, including his answers to audience questions, you can find that on our show page at whqr.org. Thanks also to WHQR's Ken Campbell for technical support, and Camille Mojica for engineering and recording Scott Simon's luncheon talk. Cammie recently left our team to prepare to head to law school. We miss her, and we wish her well. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast. If you've got questions or comments or an idea for a future show, you can reach us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.